and to an extent national security were to the 1960s and 1970s. It has become a catch-all phrase, and it has become a word of fear that is bandied about as a reason, an excuse in many cases, we feel, to cut back on civil liberties, to, in fact, suck money out of the tax-paying public, to do terrible things to people who probably don't deserve to have terrible things done to them, and that includes the tax-paying public. And, of course, it has been the major battle cry of the Reagan administration in world affairs. Everything that goes wrong in the world today has been blamed by the Reagan administration on terrorism, and, of course, specifically on Soviet-inspired terrorism. And this is something very important to bear in mind as we go through the program, and perhaps by the time you've heard some of the stuff that we put together tonight, you'll know why we happen to take the Reagan administration's protestations with perhaps a rather large grain of salt.
And for our purposes, there are really two prongs to the terrorist fork, I guess you could say. One, terrorism is being used as the rationale for a vastly expanded U.S. military presence abroad. In addition, terrorism has been cited by many people on the right as the reason why we should have our civil liberties restricted in order to combat this menace. So as you listen to the adventures of Messrs. Turple and Wilson and the various factions and elements that they connect up with, be thinking about the implications of terrorism on your life. And in particular, recall the scenario that we've brought up so many times, the device Adolf Hitler used to achieve power, in which Hitler and the Nazis burned down the Reichstag building, the German Parliament building, blamed it on the communists, and used that incident as an excuse to suspend civil liberties in Germany, and that was basically the point of assumption of dictatorial powers by Hitler.
Indeed. Now, as we proceed with the broadcast tonight, those of you out there who are already going into information phobia because you're not familiar with the people that we're talking about, never fear. We put this together, and before I go on and finish my thought, let me also just mention, too, that Dave deserves a lot of credit for an incredible amount of work, as usual, that he's done in collating this this stuff and putting it together. But we put this together in such a way as much as possible to ease you into this, to make the necessary explanations wherever possible. And any information that is outstanding that has not been mentioned tonight, we probably will have some phone segments where you can ask questions. But we're going to try and make things as clear as possible. That's the reason we're doing these archive broadcasts. Okay, first off, just to give you a general overview on what the, I suppose, the thesis statement of the broadcast is, this is a small excerpt from a book called Deadly Business, Sam Cummings, Inner Arms in the Arms Traffic, by Patrick Brogan and Albert Zarka, B-R-O-G-A-N, Brogan, and Zarka, Z-A-R-C-A. It's by W.W. Norton and Company, and it was published in 1983. And it says as follows, a report prepared by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms on the Wilson-Turple affair states, quote, we demonstrated in the current case that the United States, in effect, has become a major supplier of hardware and technology in support of worldwide terrorism. Former Central Intelligence Agency personnel, military special forces personnel, and U.S. corporations combine to supply products and expertise to whoever can pay the price. Libya, the recipient in this case, publicly admits that it gives training, weapons, and funding to terrorist organizations throughout the world, specifically admitting support of the PLO, the IRA, Red Brigades, and the Japanese Red Army. Okay, so even the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms admits that the United States has become a major supplier, some would say the major supplier, of hardware and technology to worldwide terrorism. Now, the question that we're going to be examining tonight, the fulcrum, the focal point of our argument tonight, will be whether or not this technology, hardware, and expertise is supplied knowingly or unknowingly by the military and intelligence structure of the United States. And that's what we're going to be looking into.
And take note, of course, of the fact that all of those elements, Libya, the Red Brigade, the Irish Republican Army, the Japanese Red Army, and all of those elements are openly, and at least to all accounts that we have, anti-American and are offered up to us by the media as enemies of the United States. So the question, of course, has to be raised, what is the United States, if indeed the United States, as a political entity, could be said to be arming these organizations? What are they doing in as much as these are enemies of the United States? Developing that point further, following stories from the Washington Post of June 22nd, 1981, this is a UPI story, Dateline Philadelphia, and it's headlined, Report Links Two Ex-CIA Agents to Theft of Military Radar. Two former CIA agents being sought on charges of illegal arms sales to Libya have been linked to the theft of radar equipment from a naval test site in China Lake, California, the Philadelphia Bulletin reported today. The report named Frank E. Turpel and Edwin P. Wilson as the subjects of a federal investigation into the theft of radar equipment from the U.S. Naval Testing Center at China Lake, a Southern California test center for sophisticated weaponry and electronic systems. Both men are being sought on federal fugitive warrants on charges they sold large quantities of weapons and sensitive military equipment to Muammar Gaddafi's government in Libya. The newspaper quoted an unnamed Justice Department source as saying Turpel and Wilson allegedly, quote, stole a ton of stuff from China Lake over a period of several years, unquote. The pair allegedly used CIA contacts to obtain the radar equipment, which, installed in an airplane, can detect and classify approaching aircraft as friendly or enemy craft, according to the newspaper. Turpel, who jumped bail and is believed to be out of the country, was convicted in absentia last month on gun-running charges in New York. Turpel and Wilson also have been accused in indictments of hiring former Green Berets to work in Libya, training members of international terrorist groups, including Italy's Red Brigade, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and the Irish Republican Army, the newspaper reported. So again, here we have Turpel and Wilson not only stealing very sensitive U.S. military equipment to be given to Libya, at least to all accounts we've been given, an ally of the Soviet Union and an enemy of the United States, but again, notice that Turpel and Wilson have been involved, according to this account here, with training, or basically recruiting, quote, ex-Green Berets, unquote, to train members of international terrorist organizations, including, again, the Red Brigades, the Irish Republican Army, and the Palestine Liberation Organization. So keep these organizations in mind, and keep in mind the possible reasons why the United States might be aiding groups like this.
Okay, one other thing to be aware of is is the fact that the people involved here, Turpel and Wilson, are also stealing or have been accused of stealing very large quantities of very top secret equipment, and in many cases, now not necessarily so maybe with all the China Lake stuff, but a lot of this stuff is large volume stuff. This is not the kind of things that people walk away with in their pockets, because that will come up later in the show. We're not just talking about stealing little tiny things like microfilm. We're talking about taking out large quantities of explosives, timers, etc.
And as you think about this, keep in mind, think about how easy or difficult it might be to do something like this. Imagine that you yourself or someone you know was attempting to do these same things, and think about all that would be involved in this from a practical standpoint, because that's an important point, and as Nip indicated, it's going to come up later.
Okay, this next article is a Jack Anderson column from the San Francisco Chronicle for Monday, October 20th, 1980. It's headlined, appropriately enough, Bombshell, and it goes as follows. One of the biggest bombshells in the Billy Carter case is in the classified files of the Justice Department. Locked in these files is evidence that President Carter's brother, perhaps innocently, became cozy in Libya with the leader of a ring of American mercenaries, specialists in murder and mayhem who learned their skills in the Central Intelligence Agency and military special forces. These men have been collaborating with Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi's worldwide terrorist movement. The ringleader of the mercenaries is Frank Edward Turpel, an ex-CIA agent who owns a home base close to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, and whose wife once worked for the CIA. One of his associates, Edwin Paul Wilson, is quoted in the secret files as explaining, quote, you know, the colonel, meaning Gaddafi, may sometime have some young colonels or some officers who are getting out of line that he wants to send a present to. Unquote. According to the secret files, Turpel and Wilson have recruited at least 10 U.S. Special Forces veterans who are described as, quote, trained assassins. Another 7 U.S. explosive experts and 2 men trained to make sophisticated CIA weapons have also been brought to Libya by Turpel and Wilson. The two ringleaders have been indicted for gun running and are now fugitives from the law. Intelligence sources say Wilson is hiding out in a Tripoli hotel just down the hall from the notorious international terrorist Carlos the Jackal. Terpel was last reported in Syria. Billy Carter was once in touch with Terpel, though the connection may be entirely innocent. He told Justice Department officials that he had discussed a machine gun deal with Terpel. Another time, Billy said Terpel had acted as an interpreter for him in Libya, though Terpel knows no foreign languages. Billy also said he might have signed a photograph showing himself and Terpel together in Libya to my friend Frank. Later, Billy recanted and insisted he hardly knows the man. The FBI Customs Bureau, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and two federal grand juries have been working on the case for 2 years. If only a fraction of the allegations can be proved in court, it will be one of the most incendiary political, military, intelligence scandals of the decade. The secret conclusion from Justice Department files summarized the case. Quote, the United States, in effect, has become a worldwide supplier of hardware and technology in support of worldwide terrorism. This is the same quote we heard before. Former CIA personnel, military special forces, and U.S. corporations combine to supply products and expertise to whoever can pay the price. Now, a couple of quick points to go back to very rapidly. Okay, one of them is, again, the point that Anderson is making and the continuous use of the term or the name ex-CIA or mercenaries. In other words, the claim is that these people are no longer affiliated with our intelligence services. Okay, that's something to remember because that's basically what we're examining tonight. Now, also the fact that Wilson was said to be hiding out in a Tripoli hotel, Tripoli, of course, capital of Libya, down the hall from notorious international terrorist Carlos the Jackal. And we're going to talk about Carlos the Jackal in some depth later. The last, and in some ways, we'll see one of the most prophetic things that Anderson says in this entire article. He says, if only a fraction of the allegations can be proved in court, it will be one of the most incendiary political, military, intelligence scandals of the decade. Well, we're going to talk about what happened in regards to that court case and some of the people that never managed to make it into the docket later on in the show.
Now, remember that Billy Carter was involved with, according to that account, with Terpel and Wilson. The exact nature of his involvement remains a subject of debate. At one point, Frank Terpel was actually planning on killing Billy Carter in order to punish him for having reneged on one of their proposed business ventures. But Billy Carter is just one of a number of very prominent people who come in contact with Terpel and Wilson. And again, with their role in arming terrorists and enemies of the United States, certainly that raises some questions. More here about just what it was that Terpel and Wilson gave to Muammar Gaddafi, the extent, I guess you could say, of the arming and training that they gave to Mr. Gaddafi. Another Jack Anderson column, this from the day after the one that Tuck just read you. This one is called Training Terrorists. The Chronicle basically titled Anderson's column that on October 21st of 1980. Once again, Training Terrorists. American cloak and dagger operatives have trained and equipped terrorist squads for Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. According to secret Justice Department files, the American experts have taught Gaddafi's killers how to construct sophisticated booby traps that can turn such innocent objects as a book, telephone, or a tube of toothpaste into murder weapons. The American ringleader, Frank Terpel, even offered to smuggle to Libya a U.S. red-eye missile, a shoulder-launched, heat-seeking weapon that can bring down an airliner in flight. Terpel met President Carter's brother, Billy, in Libya and apparently tried to set him up as a front for the operation. Billy Carter first admitted, then denied to Justice Department officials that Terpel had discussed a machine gun deal with him. There's no evidence Billy was ever aware Terpel was training terrorists for Gaddafi. Here are just a few startling excerpts from the classified Justice Department files. Terpel agreed to train Libyan agents in, quote, espionage, sabotage, and general psychological warfare, unquote, as well as the design, manufacture, implementation, and detonation of explosive devices, unquote. The undercover training was disguised as a mine-clearing operation. Terpel closed the deal in London with Gaddafi's brother. Beginning in mid-1976, Terpel, himself an ex-CIA agent, recruited a team of American clandestine operatives, paramilitary specialists, professional killers, and explosive experts trained by the CIA and U.S. Special Forces. By August of 1976, the Americans were ensconced in the former Winter Palace of former Libyan King Idris. At least one American quit the team, according to the secret files, because he, quote, felt innocent people eventually would get killed, unquote. In July of 1977, the Americans delivered some lethal flashlights, attaché cases, transistor radios, handheld calculators, and refrigerators, unquote, all transformed into bombs, to a Libyan colonel in Tobruk. The files relate that, quote, one of the Libyan military officers picked up one of the devices. As a result, the device, along with the rest of the explosives on the truck, detonated and killed three Libyan soldiers. Three American instructors were wounded. Veterans of the U.S. Special Forces taught the Libyans American tactics and techniques, unquote, including classified methods and maneuvers developed by the United States. One informant slipped into the palace basement arsenal and inventoried a cache of sophisticated gadgets from various American companies, quote, the invoices contained in the boxes listed thousands of timers at a price of millions of dollars, the report stated. So here we have bombs being made out of all sorts of handy everyday objects like flashlights, attaché cases, and so forth, and thousands of timing devices. And this, by way of giving you an idea of just how extensive the aid given to the Libyans was by Turple and Wilson, and the quantities involved here, again, is an important factor, because the question is, could this much material have made it out of the country and to an avowed enemy of the United States without the government knowing anything about that? And the volume of material here is a central question in eventually helping us to determine that. And so keep in mind the thousands of timing devices, and as we're going to see, tons of plastic explosives were given to Gaddafi through these corporate fronts. And again, the question is, could this have happened without the government being aware of it?
All right. Now, moving on, we come once more back to the central question, which is, did they or didn't they, do they or don't they? And, of course, what we're referring to is work for or with the knowledge of the United States government. This is the third in this series of Jack Anderson columns, this one for Wednesday, October 22nd, 1980, out of the San Francisco Chronicle. It's headlined School for Terror, and it goes like this. It's possible the CIA knew about, perhaps even condoned, the activities of U.S. mercenaries who ran a school for terrorists in Libya. The Americans were trained in undercover work and assassination by the CIA and U.S. Special Forces. They continued to draw on their contacts in the U.S. intelligence community while they rigged booby traps and taught paramilitary tactics for Libya's dictator Muammar Gaddafi. The two headmasters of the terrorist school, Frank Turple and Edwin Wilson, both former CIA agents, both wanted in the United States on gunrunning charges, are familiar figures in Tripoli. There is evidence in top-secret Justice Department files that the CIA may have been aware of the mercenaries' undercover work for Gaddafi. The files disclosed that several leads indicated CIA connivance, but could never be followed up. Here are some of the suspicious leads from the files. Two men who, quote, had been involved in the development and design of special forces type devices, unquote, were recruited to work for Gaddafi. According to the files, quote, they were highly skilled technicians from China Lake, California. This is the site in the Mojave Desert of a super secret Navy center where lethal James Bond devices are perfected. And I might add, we just mentioned that that's one of the places that the allegations were that Turple and Wilson were getting weapons from. Both men were, quote, working on classified CIA concealed weapon systems, unquote, when they were hired to impart their expertise to the Libyans. After their stint in Libya, they returned to work at China Lake, though the CIA knew of their association with Gaddafi. Turple and Wilson made a startling proposition to three CIA contract agents in September 1976. They were asked to kill a Libyan, quote, traitor, whom Gaddafi wanted eliminated, and to train the dictator's own assassins. When Turple and Wilson cited their CIA credentials, the three men flew to London and Geneva to discuss the deal. They declined a $100,000 per year offer after learning that they would be working for Gaddafi and wouldn't have the, quote, protection of the CIA. A retired veteran of the Army Special Forces received a telephone offer of $50,000 a year to put together a five-man team, quote, with expertise in intelligence operations, weapons, and demolition. The offer came from someone he apparently believed was a clandestine U.S. official, recalling him to action. He recruited four Special Forces men who, by prearrangement, turned over their birth certificates and passports to an unidentified woman at the Arlington Quality Inn in the Washington outskirts. 2 hours later, she returned with Libyan visas. Once in Libya, they discovered that their secret mission was to train Gaddafi's security forces. The leader returned to the United States and informed the FBI. Not long afterward, he received an anonymous threat to, quote, forget everything he knew about the operation in Libya, or else. So we have a 3 minute, we have three different sections here, things that, that basically suggest that the CIA is linked. The two men who went to work from China Lake back to China Lake after working, even though the CIA knew, Turple and Wilson's proposition to the three CIA contract agents, which may be the Villa Verde case that we're going to be talking about later, although it's not named here. And third, the Special Forces, Army Special Forces officer who received the offer of $50,000 a year to put together a five-man team to work in Libya. So all of these things apparently that the CIA would have at least known about, especially the China Lake case, and none of which did the CIA actively operate to stop.
Okay, now the still another alarming twist of the screw, I guess you could say here, that the terrorist screw concerns the fact that not only were Turple and Wilson shipping these vast quantities of material as well as people to train Gaddafi's people in how to use them to Gaddafi, and also, of course, the Red Brigades, the IRA, the PLO, and the organizations that we've talked about before, but apparently at one point Wilson was going to be opening a training school on his own estate for training these people in the United States with the assistance of U.S. taxpayers. This information also comes from an article, a Jack Anderson column, and the Chronicle ran, basically headlined this column, Terror Training. And this is Anderson's column from Monday, December 20th of 1982. Okay, again, Jack Anderson headlined Terror Training. The taxpayers came close to financing a terrorist training camp in Virginia 5 years ago. They were spared the expense only because the ex-CIA agent who planned the stunt wasn't getting along with his wife. This is just one of the startling revelations that turned up during an exhaustive closed-door investigation of renegade ex-CIA agent Edwin Wilson by the House Intelligence Committee. Wilson has just been convicted of illegally supplying weapons to agents of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Investigators for the House Committee interviewed more than 100 witnesses. All of them were assured anonymity and warned not to speak to the press. The committee's staff director, Thomas Latimer, seemed especially determined to keep my associate Dale Van Atta from finding out what the witnesses were telling the committee. Van Atta has been investigating the Wilson episode for more than 2 years. Keep this in mind, the committee, the staff director of the House Intelligence Committee that was investigating Ed Wilson, a fellow by the name of Thomas Latimer, last name Latimer, according to Anderson, seemed especially determined to keep my associate Dale Van Atta from finding out what the witnesses were telling the committee. We're going to refer back to that towards the end of the broadcast. Van Atta has been investigating the Wilson episode for more than 2 years. Van Atta has obtained the committee's secret transcripts. They are replete with allegations against Wilson which have never been disclosed. Wilson has been charged with supplying and helping to run a school for terrorists in Libya. According to federal investigators, the supplies provided to Gaddafi included explosives concealed in common household items such as ashtrays. Such terrorist organizations as Italy's Red Brigade, the Irish Republican Army, Japan's Red Army, and radical Palestinian groups are also believed to have enjoyed access to Wilson's materials. According to the Intelligence Committee transcript, Wilson almost got the Justice Department's now-defunct Law Enforcement Assistance Administration to put up the seed money for training terrorists at his 3,000-acre, $5 million farm in Virginia's posh horse country. Late in the spring of 1977, Wilson decided to pitch the idea to the LEAA as a counterintelligence, counterterrorism project. he began recruiting experienced law enforcement officers and CIA operatives to instruct trainees. He then prepared an LEAA grant proposal which emulated a political violence and anti-terrorism course offered at the time by the California Specialized Training Institute at San Luis Obispo. Wilson's training camp would cost money, perhaps as much as $20 million, but he was sure he could get at least part of it from Uncle Sam. One witness told the committee that Wilson, quote, had his own people over there at LEAA, unquote. Wilson met with his chief LEAA contact in mid-June of 1977, according to a committee witness who participated in the session. The witness said Wilson asked for a grant of at least $850,000, and the LEAA official, quote, assured both of us that he would walk it through. He would make sure that it goes through. The scheme collapsed when Wilson and his wife had a falling out, and he decided to drop his plan to locate the training camp at his home in Virginia, knowledgeable sources told my associates Van Atta and Indy Badoir. Through his attorney, Wilson denied having attempted to set up a terrorist training camp. So, again, with at least partial assistance from the U.S. Department of Justice through the LE Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, Edwin Wilson was going to take his terrorist training to the United States, and with at least partial support of the government and the U.S. taxpayers. And again, we see the same elements here, the Libyans, the Red Brigades, the Irish Republican Army, the radical Palestinians that Triple and Wilson were involved with in Libya and the Middle East. Okay, so in addition to the possibility of CIA that Anderson brought up, here we have the possibility of elements of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. And again, that's part of the Justice Department. And repeating this one sentence here, one witness told the committee that, quote, Wilson had his own people over there at LEAA. And so keep that in mind, that we almost wound up with these terrorists being trained in the United States.
Now, this is an important distinction for a number of reasons. Now, among the many things, now, there's you could say that there's three distinct possibilities, I suppose, in this Turple-Wilson affair. One is that Turple and Wilson are exactly what the government portrays them to be, lone wolf mercenary type, selling guns and weaponry and things like that from the U.S. to left-leaning radical groups. Two, that they could be entirely a part of the United States Intelligence Service clandestine warfare divisions, or three, that there are elements, or not even elements, that there are entire splinter groups acting with the power and authority of our clandestine intelligence and military intelligence agencies that are no longer responsive even to what controls the agencies are supposed to have over them. In other words, we may have, in fact, a form of shadow government within the government. And this is something that we've explored before during the work that we did on the Kennedy assassination. So this is a third possibility to think about, that we have a distinct split and that there may actually be whole groups or whole sections of agencies that whose loyalty has nothing to do with the agency itself, but rather to their own personal idea of what America should do and what the world should be like. Okay, this next section here is out of a book called Libyan Sandstorm by John K. Cooley, C-O-O-L-E-Y, published by Holt Reinhart and Winston in 1982. By late 1977, Cooley writes, Gaddafi had sent Wilson to provide support and expertise to Gaddafi's friend Idi Amin Dada, the Ugandan dictator, and to Robert Astles, A-S-T-L-E-S, Amin's British security chief. Investigating the arms traffic charges against Wilson and Turple that finally led to their arrest and first arraignment in New York in December 1979, New York State undercover agents taped conversations with Turple in which he boasted that he had personally trained Carlos, one of the world's most notorious terrorists, years after the Venezuelans' earlier training in the USSR. Was this true or merely one of Turple's many exercises in self-glorification? The author asks. Certainly Turple's claim is plausible. In late August of 1973, Carlos, seeking a secure base in London, rented flats in Bayswater and Applecourt as places of refuge. Carlos, who had never been to Libya, desperately wanted to meet Muammar al-Gaddafi and offer him his services. On September 10, 1973, Carlos contacted Hamid Habib, a young attaché at the Libyan embassy in London who was one of Gaddafi's close friends. Habib told Carlos that George Habash, H-A-B-B-A-S-H, the Christian Palestinian physician who headed the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the most radical of the Palestinian organizations, had recommended Carlos to the Libyans. After 12 days of reflection, Habib asked Carlos to fly to Tripoli. Gaddafi, according to two authors with close connections to Israel's Secret Service, talked with Carlos and agreed to help him.
So here you basically have two more very notorious names on the international terrorist scene. First of all, Idi Amin, the notorious ex-dictator of Uganda, and again a sworn and outspoken enemy of the United States, is also the beneficiary of Messrs. Turple and Wilson's expertise. And perhaps even more importantly, take note of the name Carlos the Jackal, maybe the single best-known name on the terrorist scene today, and always affiliated in the popular literature with the Soviet Union and left-leaning elements. And, well, what can you say? Here we have Frank Turple boasting of having trained Carlos the Jackal, and we've also seen how Gaddafi Carlos alliance apparently was forged. And so you have the Turple Wilson friend Gaddafi working with the possible Turple Wilson ally Carlos. Okay, and again, Turple himself claims to have trained Carlos the Jackal. Now, at the very top of the broadcast, Niptuck read you from a book called Deadly Business, subtitled Sam Cummings, Inter-Arms and the Arms Trade, by Patrick Brogan and Albert Zarka. I'd like to go back to that book and read you a little bit more about the possibility of Turple and Wilson's involvement with Carlos the Jackal. Much of the evidence against Wilson and Turple was provided by Kevin Mulcahy, last name M-U-L-C-A-H-Y. Mulcahy was a CIA agent, son of a CIA agent, brother of two others. His career with the agency was in electronics. He left in 1968 and was hired by Wilson in 1975 as an expert in electronics and radio communications. He was made a director of one of Wilson's companies, Intertechnology Incorporated, and worked happily for Wilson and Turple for 18 months until he discovered that they were supplying Gaddafi with the means to carry out assassinations. He later told the FBI that he was once at a party on a bridge in the River Thames together with Turple and a number of others, including the celebrated international terrorist Carlos Sanchez Ramirez. Wilson asked Mulcahy to take a clean, unquote, gun to Cairo, one that could not be traced, to be used in an assassination. He refused. Wilson later asked him to obtain a red-eye missile. It is a shoulder-held surface-to-air missile, and Mulcahy deduced that Wilson wanted it for Gaddafi, who intended to give it to the PLO to shoot down an airliner. Just such an attack was attempted on an El Al plane at the Rome airport and another at Orly in Paris. This was too much for Mulcahy, who went to the FBI late in 1976. He was not listened to, and this is the most curious aspect of the whole affair. Wilson was not indicted for another 4 years, despite many official investigations by public prosecutors, the FBI, and the CIA. So again, Kevin Mulcahy, a former employee of Turple and Wilson's, blows the whistle on them, testifies that he was at a party involving not only Turple, but also Carlos Ramirez Sanchez. They call him Sanchez Ramirez, whatever. And perhaps even more importantly, that after Mulcahy blows the whistle, Wilson isn't arrested for 4 years after Mulcahy informs the federal authorities, at least as far as we know, informs the federal authorities for the first time that this sort of thing is going on. So keep in mind Mulcahy's blowing the whistle on Turple and Wilson, the fact that that apparently didn't bear any fruit for 4 years, and the fact that he actually claims to have seen Carlos at a party with Turple and others on a yacht in the River Thames.
Mulcahy's blowing the whistle on Wilson also will become significant in just a little while on the broadcast, and what fruit it did bear we will also find out about in just a while. Okay. Now, we're getting into the next section here, which is the stuff surrounding the trial of Edwin Wilson, which many of you out there will remember when it occurred, and you may not remember all the details, and some of them are quite interesting. Okay, this first article is from the San Francisco Chronicle for Thursday, February 17th, 1983. It's headlined, Assassination Plot Charged. Okay, it goes as follows. Convicted former CIA agent Edwin P. Wilson and his son, Eric, age 22, were indicted by a federal grand jury yesterday on charges they offered $1.2 million for the assassination of two Washington prosecutors and six others as the elder Wilson awaited trial last fall. The New York indictment said Edwin Wilson, a millionaire who left the agency in 1971, approached a fellow inmate about hiring a hitman in November while in custody at the Metropolitan Correctional Center on Manhattan's Lower East Side. The prisoner, Wayne Trimmer, a convicted murderer, put Wilson in touch with an FBI agent posing as a hired killer, the grand jury charged. Eric Wilson, who allegedly delivered a $9,800 down payment for the murders in a LaGuardia Airport motel men's room last month, surrendered yesterday to federal agents in New York. The younger Wilson, who lives in a Northwest Washington townhouse owned by his father, was at first ordered held in lieu of $1 million bail. U.S. District Judge Edward Weinfeld later reduced bail to $500,000 and scheduled March 8th to hear a defense motion to separate Eric Wilson's trial from his father's. A lawyer for both men entered pleas of innocent to the charges. Skipping on down, the two prosecutors allegedly targeted for death were identified as E. Lawrence Barcella Jr. and Carol Bruce, both of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia. Skipping down, yesterday's indictment charged that Edwin Wilson later added two more names to the list. Rafael Quintero, Quintero, a Cuban exile whom Wilson allegedly tried to recruit to assassinate the Libyan dissident. And Francis Haidt, H-E-Y-D-T, a former business associate who prosecutors said owed Wilson $3.2 million. Now, one of the key things to bear in mind here, and if I may indulge in a little bit of editorializing for a moment, is why Edwin Wilson, a man who obviously could get in charge with and get in touch with at least his family members directly if he could send his son to make a $10,000 down payment, why Edwin Wilson, a man who is an intimate of Carlos the Jackal, you know, obviously in the same social circle with Idi Amin, George Habash, et cetera, et cetera, why Edwin Wilson would approach somebody doing a life term for murder in the in Manhattan's Lower East Side Metropolitan Correctional Center and ask him to find him a hitman. I think any sensible person would have to ask this, regardless of what their political persuasion is, why Ed Wilson would stoop to this kind of thing. One of the reasons this is significant is because this was the assassination plot that was blown up in all the papers. Wilson was actually convicted for this assassination plot some months later, while, as we will see later on, many of the other people that were involved with the Ed Wilson case came to rather interesting conclusions themselves, and in fact all were found to be in no way unnatural deaths. They were all found to be suicides, natural deaths, etc. We'll talk about that in a moment. Last but not least, please notice the name Rafael Quintero, a Cuban exile who according to the indictment, Wilson also added to this death list. We're going to be talking about Mr. Quintero in just a moment.
Okay, now note that supposedly Wilson was blocked from murdering these witnesses and prosecutors. Okay, keep that in mind. Following article is from the Miami News of Thursday, September 23rd of 1982. This research for us by Ted Rubenstein. This was written by two authors, two Miami News journalists, Tom Dubock, D-U-B-O-C-K, and Heather Dewar, D-E-W-A-R. It's headlined, TikTok's defendant says he's witness in Libya hit team case. Operation TikTok's defendant Raul Villaverde said he is a key federal witness against former CIA agent Edwin Wilson, who is charged with conspiring to assassinate a Libyan dissident and recruiting Americans to train terrorists for Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Villaverde, who said he is a CIA-trained explosives expert, said Wilson met him in Geneva in 1976 along with Villaverde's brother Rafael and another man Villaverde identified as a CIA operative, Rafael Chichi Quintero. In a two-hour interview with the Miami News, Villaverde said Wilson tried to recruit them to train terrorists in Libya and to assassinate a Libyan dissident in Cairo. The three turned down the contract, Villaverde said. Villaverde said he blew the whistle on Wilson and his fugitive co-defendant Frank Turpel, another former CIA agent, in 1977, when federal prosecutors subpoenaed him for questioning in the Washington, D.C. assassination of former Chilean ambassador Orlando Letelier. Skipping down in this article, Raul Villaverde said he was one of the individuals Wilson tried to recruit. Villaverde said the others were his brother Rafael and Quintero. Quintero could not be reached. It is not known where he lives. Villaverde said the Cuban-born Quintero is about 40 years old and 5'6". He wears a toupee and dark glasses constantly, Villaverde said. He lived in Miami as recently as 2 years ago, Villaverde also said. Raul Villaverde said that to his knowledge, he is the only member of the trio now cooperating with federal prosecutors. Rafael Villaverde, his brother, disappeared in March after his boat exploded in the Bahamas. Raul said he thinks his brother was accidentally killed in the blast. A body was never found, and Rafael is still listed as a defendant in TikToks. TikToks, by the way, is a drug bust in which Rafael Villaverde and some others were arrested via a bug placed behind a clock, hence the name TikToks. Skipping down in the same article, Villaverde said he heard nothing about the matter until April of 1977, when an article appeared in the Washington Post stating that Wilson and three unnamed Cuban exiles were wanted for questioning in the September 21, 1976 bomb murder of Letelier. Quoting informed sources, it noted the three exiles had arrived in Washington 3 days before Letelier was murdered. Soon after the article appeared, Villaverde said, he was subpoenaed to appear before the Letelier grand jury. Villaverde said he smelled a rat and was angry. I told Letelier prosecutor Eugene Proper that it was all a setup, that if the government wanted to do that to me, then screw the government, Villaverde said. I told him I had nothing to do with it. Proper would not comment. The Villaverdes in Quintero were not charged in the Letelier case. American-born Michael Townley, a Chilean intelligence agent, was convicted in the case, but the conviction was overturned on appeal. Two Cuban-born anti-Castro activists, Vigilio Pablo Paz and José Dionisio Suárez, are still being sought in the case. During his meeting with the Letelier prosecutors, Villaverde said, quote, we told them exactly what happened, so they started the investigation and they were taking the two things at the same time, Letelier and Wilson, and that's how the whole thing came about. Well, first of all, note that one of the people on those on that list, Mr. Quintero, was, along with Raul and Rafael Villaverde, the three Cubans who were recruited by Edwin Wilson initially to kill a, so they thought, to kill Carlos the Jackal, but actually to kill a Libyan dissident, an opponent of Gaddafi's. Notice that although Quintero is not to be found, that one of these three, Rafael Villaverde, dies in the explosion of a boat. Okay, so this is the first of a number of deaths that we're going to see in connection with the Wilson case. And keep in mind that one of his buddies was a name on Wilson's hit list, and that Wilson was supposedly foiled from assassinating all of the witnesses and prosecutors. And also keep in mind the assassination of Orlando Letelier. We're going to be coming back to that. Of course, Orlando Letelier was one of the key officials of the Allende regime in Chile and had been a very outspoken opponent of the Pinochet regime and was working here in the United States to oppose the Chilean junta, put in, of course, by ITT and the United States intelligence apparatus in 1973. And, of course, the assassination of Orlando Letelier was originally bruited about in the American press as a killing of the left.
Indeed, and that is, of course, one of the main patterns that we're going to see here tonight is that, again, Wilson and Turpel find their time, we find them spending their time hanging out with people like the Red Brigades, the IRA, the Japanese Red Army faction, et cetera, et cetera. Various groups that whose activities, of course, rebound, and of course the PLO also, whose activities invariably rebound to the discredit of the left. The Munich massacre of 1972 being a primary example. Carlos the Jackal being involved in that, yet the people they seem to be bringing into these groups or getting involved with these groups all seem to be, first of all, right-wing paramilitary activists who've all worked for the CIA or are working for the CIA or various other American intelligence groups. And second of all, when the trail begins to come to light, we notice this series of deaths beginning. And as you will notice, there are an entire series. Okay, Wilson was indicted for these so-called attempts at assassination, but in fact, people who are directly involved with the Wilson case will find up cropping up dead in large numbers, every single one of them found to be dead not for having anything to do with the Wilson case, but invariably for something else.
And also keep in mind the assassination of Orlando Letelier, because we're going to come back to that later in the program. So Quintero is on Wilson's list. Wilson supposedly is prevented from knocking these people off, but one of Quintero's buddies, Rafael Villaverde, drops dead under very strange circumstances. His boat explodes, and he's no more to be found.
Okay. Another interesting case, a man by the name of Ricardo Morales, otherwise known as Monkey Morales. We're going to talk about him in a moment. This article is from the San Francisco Chronicle from March 13, 1983. It's headlined, "The Barroom Death of a Shadowy Legend." The man they're talking about is, as I mentioned before, Ricardo Morales, otherwise known as Monkey Morales. And he is shot dead in a bar. I should just briefly tell you, because we're not going to read the whole article. He's shot dead in a bar by apparently a patron of the bar. The police find that it was all on the up and up. Do not even press charges. Supposedly, Morales had gotten into an argument with his bar patron over something that he thought the bar patron had said, according to the police. Okay, reading from the article. It's by Edward Cody from the Washington Post originally. Morales also was the chief informer for Miami police last year in an elaborate drug investigation called Operation TikToks because of a bug hidden behind a clock in a suspect's home. Briefly, I will mention that was, of course, the operation Dave was speaking of in the last article that he was reading as regards the Villaverde brothers and Rafael Quintero. The case was eventually thrown out of court because a judge ruled that Morales lacked credibility. But not before Rafael Villaverde and his brother Raul were charged with conspiracy to distribute cocaine. Friends say Morales had long wanted to nail Rafael Villaverde, a fellow Cuban. Villaverde, a Bay of Pigs veteran, had been a CIA operative in Miami during the agency's Cuban destabilization campaign in the early 1960s. Morales' friends say they did not know why Morales had it in for him, meaning Villaverde, but Morales also was a CIA operative in the anti-Cuban campaign and a friend of former CIA agent Edwin P. Wilson. As a young CIA officer, Wilson had participated in the anti-Cuba campaign for which Miami was the chief launching pad. Anti-Cuban campaign veterans Rafael and Raul Villaverde had said they met Wilson in Geneva in September 1976 because they thought Wilson was recruiting them for a CIA plan to kill an international terrorist called Carlos the Jackal. But by then, Wilson was working for Colonel Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, according to a U.S. investigators. He was proposing instead a plot to kill a Libyan dissident. The Villaverdes went to the U.S. authorities with the proposal. Their denunciation became part of an investigation that has landed Wilson in jail. Okay, so Ricardo Monkey Morales, a former member of the Cuban exile movement working for the CIA as a CIA agent, along with Rafael Villaverde, who, according to this article, joined Operation TikToks to get a hold of Villaverde and to nail him.